What is going on, guys? This is In the Zone. I'm here as always with Giancarlo Aulino. And today is going to be another interesting start to our podcast. We waited for quite some time, Aulino, for this big fish to get signed. It's already been about a month almost since the free agent frenzy. Our boy, former Leaf, Nazem Kadri, finally gets signed. There were rumors swirling saying it was going to be the Islanders, but Lou Lamoriello was caught napping, didn't sign him. Instead, Brad Treliving, who you look at the amount of moves that Calgary has made this offseason, I think it's laughable, but they might arguably be better than last year. What are your thoughts on Nazem Kadri going to the Calgary Flames? 7 years, $7 million per.
Yeah, I love the deal, especially for Calgary. That's a really great fit. Like, you look at all the guys they have, and then Lucic there in the third line. You got grinding guys like Kadri coming in. They fill the void for Tkachuk, who moves on. You got Huberto coming in, filling the void for Johnny Hockey. So if I'm a Calgary fan, I'm happy. The organization were forced to make these kind of moves. They're backed in a corner, and they go and get the best free agent available other than Gaudreau, and they go and make that big move and re-sign Huberto too. So this is making them a better team. I think Calgary in the West, they can actually make a deeper run this year with these guys into it. And they have Markstrom still there. So I am happy if I am a Calgary Flames fan, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than not having anybody, right? You get rid of Gaudreau, who's arguably been probably their best point producer since Jerome McGinley. That's a name from the past. But Monahan, again, dude, this is another player they just let go. They gave, I think it was Monahan for a first and a future. Or no, Monahan and a first. Was it? I think Montreal gave up the first. No, I think they gave up the first here.
And they got the first back from the Florida pick. I think goes to Montreal because of the salary. I think Monahan's salary was too high.
Oh, my God. So it was Monahan and the first for future considerations. What do you think about that one too, man? Because we're looking at teams like Montreal and Ottawa and how much they've improved this year. What do you think a guy like Sean Monahan can bring to Montreal?
I was actually surprised. I love the move. Like, Monahan, even though he's injury prone, I think he's a player a lot of teams would love to have. He's still relatively young. He's not washed up, but I think they were just looking at it, like the injuries and all the concerns there from Calgary, and they thought, we got to move a piece like this if we want to get Kadri in long term. We know Kadri's not going to miss time unless he's suspended and doesn't have an injury history like that. So I think Montreal took a chance. Looking at their team, I don't think they're too far off either. They look at what Ottawa did, and Ottawa was aggressive. The Leafs, even though they weren't as aggressive as other teams, they still have Matthews and Marner. So Montreal was in the mix, I think, for Bergeron, but he decided to go back to Boston. And now it looks like they got a good team now. They got Monahan coming in, fills a void there at center that they need. They have a lot of depth, and they're going to make things interesting in that division.
Honestly, Aulino, I think if they had a perennial, not superstar, but like a perennial top four defenseman, because I think their best D right now is who, Matheson or Dennis Savard? Like, that's not good enough. So if they had a guy, let's say they trade for Chychrun, which Ottawa apparently has been rumored to do. If Montreal had a guy like Chychrun, oh man, they're arguably better than Boston going into the year, because you look at, you said it perfectly, Montreal for the longest time, since Plekanec retired, there's been that void at the center spot. You know, I really do like Nick Suzuki. Don't get me wrong. I think he's a phenomenal 200-foot centerman. But the expectations that are, you know, given to a young player, especially in Montreal, I hear fans saying this guy can get 90 points, be the best two-way player in the league. And it's like, okay, this could definitely ruin a player. So the fact now that Nick Suzuki has help in Kirby Dach, who's another young up-and-comer and a great leader in Sean Monahan, like you mentioned, probably arguably should have been the captain for Calgary a couple of years ago, but they have depth now down the middle. They have Cole Caulfield, who to me is absolutely money. I think he's going to be a superstar-type player. St. Louis was his favorite player growing up, so that motivates him as well. I just got to ask this question because, you know, we're Leaf fans. Out of all the moves between Montreal and Ottawa, who do you see being the more effective team this season?
I think that for this season, I'll go Ottawa, but in like 2 to 3 years' time, I think Montreal is going to benefit from Monahan, even though he's not going to be maybe a 30-goal scorer that he once was. I think just him being in the room, the kind of competitor he was, will boost some morale for the Habs. It will help some of their younger players along. If you're not even going to have Carey Price in, he's going to be LTIR for the season. You got a guy like Monahan in. You lost Shea Weber's influence on the team. So overall, I think 2 years from now, we'll start to see the positives from this move. But right now, I like, as much as it pains me to say, I like Ottawa and what they've done so far.
I hate saying that, but I got to agree. I like how they got the Brinkifer, literally, what's his name? Kevin Korchinski, whatever. That's fine. Chicago's trying to tank for Bedard. I'm trying to get over that, but I got to go bring it back to Calgary, man. I want to quickly talk about Kadri, because Kadri and Huberto now being signed, both well over 5 years, I think is just something that you look at as a Calgary fan. Yeah, they're both in their 30s and relatively at the end of those contracts, it might not look too pretty. But if it's front-loaded, if they're getting a lot of the salary now off the bat, then I think it's a home run, because you mentioned it perfectly. They can arguably go on a deep playoff run next year just as far as they went this year. And call me crazy, I blame Dallas for Calgary not beating Edmonton. Dude, they battered and bruised the shit out of Calgary. If you watch that series, you have guys like Jamie Benn, Joe Pavelski, Heiskanen, even Oleksiak, like going after you in a 7-game series. You're going to get tired after a while. So, you know, they have Markstrom, who is probably a top 5 goalie. Their defense core adding a gem there. You see on the board there, Mackenzie Weegar as well, a very undervalued move. I think, honestly, man, the Battle of Alberta has never been more dangerous in a very long time. I think both these teams can easily, in my opinion, win the East and go to the Stanley Cup Finals.
Yeah, can you imagine all the battles? Like, if you're McDavid, you got to worry about Kadri coming after you all the time. And you know the coach is going to say, we need you to go after him, because Sutter's like a hard-nosed old-school guy. He gets Kadri now on his team. I think he's going to love this, so I really like even the forward depth on Calgary. You still have Toffoli there who can score goals. You have all these guys that maneuver well and get their like space in the offensive zone on a power play that are skilled. So Huberto, I think, is going to benefit a lot. He's going to have open space. And you got to look at Edmonton. Like, yeah, you got Draisaitl, you got McDavid, but like down the line there, Hyman can only do so much. So unless you bring in a guy like Phil Kessel, and I know there's a crazy rumor out there about them going after Patrick Kane, I think they're going to be forced to make a big move because of this right now.
I agree. I think that just seals that Trey Living won the offseason. The fact that Edmonton is openly stating, yeah, we're trying to get Patrick Kane, we're trying to, you know, win the Stanley Cup. To me, it's kind of ironic because, again, who wants to play? First of all, Daryl Sutter, that guy's a freak. That guy is a scary-ass dude. He's a coach that you respect the shit out of him when he coaches you, but, like, you're facing him. He's giving you death looks. He's tapping Lucic on the back, saying, yeah, you got to go out there and deck this guy. And now you had a pest in Nazem Kadri that can potentially get 80 points. I love this move for Calgary. I know a lot of guys that I know say it's an overpay, but on the bright side, he didn't get $8.5 million, because if he did, Nazem Kadri would probably be one of the most hated players in the league.
And just even like on this, of what Edmonton is going to have to do, do you even buy into that? Like Patrick Kane, like how the hell are they going to manage to scrounge up the assets for this one? Do you think there's any truth to this rumor?
If there is, man, and I've heard a lot of ridiculous rumors with Chicago. I even saw that they want to just ship out Seth Jones. And nobody wants this guy because, dude, $9 million, that's a lot of money. Now, my biggest question mark is you have to definitely include one of their best prospects. So probably that defenseman, Philip Broberg, probably have to, it's going to probably be salary dump for salary dump if they don't want to retain anything. Let's say, I don't know, you do Patrick Kane at $10.5 million for Darnell Nurse at $9 million. Then that's something that maybe I'm okay with. You take the more offensive-minded approach. You still have Evan Bouchard, who I think could he's not as defensively sound as Nurse, but one would argue that Bouchard in a couple of years is easily going to be the best defenseman on the Edmonton Oilers. So, Alino, I'll start there. I think if you really want to get rid of Patrick Kane, and trust me, Chicago wants to. I think they want Connor Bedard more than any other team in the league. I think a starting negotiation period would probably be Patrick Kane for Nurse, I think.
Wow. Yeah, I can, if the salary matches, is a guy I think they would be willing to do it with, but like Nurse and Jones, you think you could put your team at risk of winning too many games if they start to turn it around? Because those two guys defensively kind of similar, and they can score, they could put up points. So would you have to trade Seth Jones out right away to make sure you're tanking?
I don't even know, man, because like there's times Seth Jones is absolutely phenomenal, like a Norris, almost a Norris type of D, and then there's other times he looks like Jake Gardner out there. He's a chicken with his head cut off. He can't make any good defensive plays. He goes a -5 in a game. It depends what their ideology is. I'll, you know, picture this. You have Lucas Reichel, a rookie on the top line, with a guy like Tyler Johnson and Kubalik, let's say. And then you have the back end, Nurse and Seth Jones, both at $9 million. Your defense is top heavy in salary cap. But guess what? We just saw that the NHL is coming off the most highly scored seasons in the last 20 years. What does that mean, Alino? If you can't score, you're not winning games. So even if they have Nurse and Jones, let's say there's probably going to be, if you're betting on any of those games, you bet the under, because it's probably going to be like 3-1 every game. But regardless, dude, this Chicago team, I don't see them contending at all, even if they still have Patrick Kane, because they got rid of Hagel and freaking DeBrincat. And those were arguably their two blue chip, marketable young forwards. And now, yeah, you know, Patrick Kane is probably, call me crazy, the greatest American player of all time. But they're 34 years old now and they're dead in the water. So to answer your question, I still think if they have Jones and Nurse, I still think that is good enough to be tanking for dead last.
Do you think there's like any other team, like they're actively making it known to Jonathan Toews? Like, I've never seen a team go and make a working environment like that bad just for a captain to give the message, like, we want you gone. Like, what's going to take for us to convince you that we don't want you here? And he still like seems committed, but it looks like he's finally getting a little grumpy about it. Like, if you're Jonathan Toews, what's the best option now that Calgary doesn't seem like a possibility?
I think the best option for him, man, is just to go home, go back to Winnipeg, go chill with your family, you know, stay close to home. 34, 35 years old. He's got all the accolades in the world. The only problem is if he is out there saying to managers, I want to play winning hockey and be in the playoffs, can Winnipeg really offer that? Maybe they're a bubble team next year, but I don't really see them in the same light as I have in years past. Yeah, you know, Scheifele's great. Kyle Connor's coming off, what, like almost 100 points, 40 goals, but their D is just so dry. They have Ville Heinola, who is a young up-and-coming D, but how much can Josh Morrissey really do on his own? Not much. Hellebuck is a hell of a goalie. I still think he's a little bit overrated, but he's still a great goalie nonetheless, and my biggest question, again, like what we've talked about with Seth Jones and Patrick Kane, like, what does the trade look like? Because there's so much salary attached to Jonathan Toews.
Yeah, it'd probably be 50% for sure. You would have to get a third team involved. They would have to maybe retain another 20%. Or depending on who you trade them to, maybe a buyout. But that's going to involve probably a first round, maybe second round, couple picks.
I was going to say, like, what do you think is a respectable salary for him right now? If you just had to, let's say he was a free agent and you have to sign Jonathan Toews, what do you expect? 3.5, $4 million.
Yeah, if he wants to play winning hockey and he's going in with that mindset, like, I'm willing to take a pay cut and sacrifice playing time to win a championship again, I would say 3.5 to 4. If he wants to be the guy on a team, then maybe he can get 5.5 from a team, but they're not going to make the playoffs. So his best bet would be Arizona, and I don't think he wants to go there. So I think 3.5, I think, is a fair deal for someone like him. The kind of championship pedigree he has, he can still play if he's healthy, reliable minutes, third line, penalty kill, shutdown guys. So I'd go 3.5 for a guy like him.
So you just said a tremendous point that leads me to my thought. And, you know, if it's 3.5 to 4 million, probably 2 first-round picks would have to be involved in order to get Jonathan Toews off of the books. So let's say, like, dude, Chicago would have to give up quite a bit. I think if, let's say, 50% retained, that's at 5.25 million. You have to give up probably a first, 2 firsts to get him. And I think a team perfectly set up for that, whether it's a first-round pick for the next couple years down the line, I think it's still Colorado. If Jonathan Toews wants to win, and there are teams out there that low-key they need a first-round pick, because Landeskog's 31, 32. MacKinnon is going to get $13 million on his next contract. I think the window for the Avalanche is, call me crazy, relatively small. I don't think they're going to do what Tampa did, where they've been dominant for 10 years. I mean, this is a league now where you need to sign those big-time players. And yeah, Makar is signed, and MacKinnon obviously is going to be signed with no problem. But, dude, it's going to get to a point where you're probably going to have to let Landeskog go, or you're going to have to let Nichushkin go. So there's always going to be a piece that's gone. And if I'm Colorado, dude, Jonathan Toews being on the third, fourth line, I think, just seals the deal, especially for next year's chances to repeat.
Yeah, I can see that. And another sneaky team I'm not going to rule out. I know they would have to maybe do a little bit of cap dumping and sneaky trades, but a team under the radar I can see make a play for Jonathan Toews. It might sound crazy, but the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Oh, man.
They got a lot of cap that they can throw around there. They got a player that they can move around. If they're smart with it, and they see Chicago willing to get a third team involved, if they dump some future considerations and another draft pick to another team, I can see Toews being a Columbus Blue Jacket.
I'm going to throw up. That I cannot see happening, but anything is possible. We saw Huberto get freaking traded. So, you know, we got to actually, before we move on, got to talk quickly about some Leaf action. Unfortunately, we saw a couple years back, Aline. I remember it was our first episode or second episode. We talked about the William Nylander holdout. Rasmus Sandin is still far away from signing that contract. They're at a standstill. No progression in the talks. What do you expect the Maple Leafs to do in order to get this job done? Do you see a guy? Because we've been talking about this, I swear to God, for 4 months with Kerfoot. Is Kerfoot the guy to go just to sign Sandin, or is it a guy like a Jake Muzzin where you sacrifice experience to re-sign a youngster in Rasmus Sandin?
Yeah, this is a tricky situation for Dubas because he made all these moves at the free agency opening, even at the trade deadline, not deadline, but that trade opening period before the draft. And he didn't really sign Sandin. It's like he kind of hoped for Sandin to call him up and his agent and say, yeah, we'll take a little bit of a pay cut on a 2-year bridge deal. And that didn't happen. So he backed himself in a corner because he's giving out no trade clauses to some players that he's signing and doesn't really have enough cap space. So I think this is going to lead to arbitration the most. I do see Sandin as a Leaf because I don't think a team would just go off and say, we'll give you $5 million and take a risk on a guy who's still kind of not even proven yet. So I think this is going to come down to Sandin getting his money, and it might be a 1-year deal.
So what are you expecting, about 1 year at $3 million? Like something, yeah. Something about, the, yeah. Here's the concerning thing. If you're Toronto, you look at the back end and you look at the bottom four. So you have Giordano, you have Hull for whatever reason still playing. and you have Muzzin and Brody. So, like, dude, that's loaded. And even Liljegren is there too. If you want to even put, so let's say the first line is Riley and Brody. The second line is going to be Liljegren and Giordano, and then you have Muzzin and Hall. So what is it going to take for a guy like Rasmus Sandin? You pay him $3 million. How many games are you expecting for him to play? Because, dude, the last couple of years, even with guys like Justin Hall, who you expect he's going to outplay, he doesn't get the playing time. So I don't blame Sandin for holding out, because I feel like if I was him, I would feel disrespected. I know Liljegren, great journey. I thought this was going to be a player like that was going to get Jeremy Bracco. I thought he was going to be out of the league, out of the team in 2-3 years. But here he is. He's probably one of our better offensive-minded D. He's literally, to me, he's Barry 2.0. I think he's so elusive and so offensive-minded. But then you have a guy here, Rasmus Sandin, we traded down for. We traded Konechny for Sandin, technically. I mean, we didn't technically draft Konechny, but we could have. So, dude, if you're in Sandin's position, what are you thinking right now? Do you feel respected? Do you feel like you're a blue-chip prospect? Because if I'm him, it's kind of the vision's blurry, I think, in Dubas's eyes nonetheless.
Yeah, valid point there. I think he kind of feels disrespected in a way because he looks at some of the other younger players. Like when Morgan Riley came in, he got some playing time right away, but they eased him into it. Eventually, he took over. But a guy like Jake Gardner had some rough patches. He was a defenseman. Liljegren even hasn't really had a chance. Had to go through the Marlies. But Nick Robertson, he probably sees this guy got an opportunity in the playoffs. And he got a chance to succeed, have a chance to make mistakes. And I think Sandin felt like, in a way, this season he wasn't given that same opportunity where if he made a mistake, he was like blamed and pushed down the lineup, got some playing time reduced. So I think this is his way of showing, like, do you really value me to be here long term? Or do I just have to look elsewhere and see if I can make my money there and prove that I am a top four, top two defenseman in the league?
Another thing, too, is I think it's the narrative and the approach that maybe his agent and himself want to go in. It's either you do the Jacob Trouba approach where you go to arbitration, you get your money for a year, and then you prove it. It's like a bet on yourself type of contract. Like, okay, I'm signed 1 year here. I'll be an RFA again next summer, and let's see if I can get a 3 to 5 year deal after next season. So, and here's another thing, Alino. After this season with the Leafs, I think their blue line is going to need just absolute reconstructive surgery. Like Giordano's 38, 39. Jake Muzzin is an old 34, 35 now. TJ Brody, I love his defensive effort, but this is a guy where as the years go on too, he's losing a step. We need Sandin. He's a great two-way guy. And if I'm Dubas, I'm trying to trade either one of those meaningful roster players just to keep him long-term, because I think he could be that good. And if you have Liljegren, Sandin, and Riley at least playing together well into Riley's 30s, I think that's only a win for the Leafs. And it's definitely going to be frustrating. I don't know what to expect because we've been in salary cap hell for so many years now. And we're always trying to make some certain adjustment. And, you know, for the most part, it doesn't necessarily work out. Aubie Kubel, that signing to me, man, I don't know. Even Adam Gaudette, he had some great time in Vancouver. But if you're signing these guys and a guy like Sandin, who's supposed to be so important to your franchise, let's say Gaudette and Aubie Kubel, dude, play 35 games each. What does that say? Again, I'm bringing up the respect factor. If you're Sandin, you're looking at that. You're paying two guys combined at 2.5 mil. That probably could have been my money, and they're playing 70 games combined of the 164. So I don't know. Like Dubas, I get what he's doing with the tweaking of the fourth line and all that, but when push comes to shove, you have a guy like Sandin who's a first-round pick. You got to sign the guy.
Yeah, like even looking at their salary cap here, I'll just pull it up. Just they are in cap hell, like you mentioned, because they have guys that I know the retained salary factor played a big role, but you look at active contracts, what their cap table is looking at, they still have negative $1.493 million in cap space. So if they even want to sign Sandin to like a $3 million deal, there's a lot of guys here that they need to move out, because I don't see where it's going to happen. Unless Muzzin, he has a signing bonus that probably kicked in already. He has $2 million that you can put out there, but you got to find a team that's going to take him, and you have to convince him because he has a full no move clause.
Yeah, I agree there. And, you know, I'm looking at some contracts there. Simmons, David Kampf, Pierre Engvall, Kerfoot. I think those are all guys that, you know, you appreciate the grind and you appreciate their story and their effectiveness on the Leafs, but that's a lot of salary right there. You know, Kampf, great 200-foot player. We needed a guy like him in the postseason, but you look at what Engvall just got. You look at Wayne Simmons getting $1 million again to what, play 30 games and get 200 penalty minutes. Like, those are salaries where you look at, even though regardless, Alino, if it's a 1 year, a 2 year, a 5 year, it's going to bite you in the ass, especially in these instances. So I think we're already almost in September. I think maybe in 2 weeks' time, as the seat gets a little warmer for Dubas to sign Sandin, I think we might actually finally, Alino, see a possible trade.
And do you see another name here, William Nylander? He's got a nice contract, and you can actually
hidden gem
control where he goes, because you look here, full no move for Tavares. He's not going anywhere. You got Muzzin, Brody, modified. Murray, you just got. Oh, my God. Kerfoot has a modified no move. Fuck. Oh, my God.
That's why we haven't traded him yet.
He's accomplished so much in the league that he gets to get a modified no move. But that's his agent. Good for them. But, yeah, it looks like Nylander is the one you can control the destination. Does that look like a move as your salary cap goes down so much that you're going to have to be forced to make?
Oh, man. We've been talking about this for a long time. And this is no disrespect to Willie, but, yeah, it's going to have to happen eventually. To me, he is going to do exactly what Matt Tkachuk did after his first contract. I think Willie, dude, honestly, he had, 82 points this season. I think he's going to get around 8.5 on his next contract. He knows, and all the media knows and puts out there, that this contract's an absolute steal. You're just looking at what the hell this guy's been doing. He's one of the more elusive forwards on our team. And just seeing what he's doing, man, it's just absolutely insane. And the fact that he doesn't have a no-move clause, wow, that's I feel for Nylander. A guy of his stature should have a no-move clause. He should have that you know, that control and that power, but he doesn't. And a guy like Kerfoot, who, again, doesn't get over 50 points, has a no-move clause because, what, he was in the Nazem Kadri trade? Whoop-dee-doo. Like you know what, dude? What are your thoughts on this? I feel like Dubas saw Kerfoot as a number two center for sure. Because if you're going to trade Kadri for Tyson Barrie for a year and Alex Kerfoot and put a no movement clause on Kerfoot, what the hell were the expectations that Dubas had on Kerfoot?
I honestly think he thought Kerfoot was going to light it up and be a Kadri without the suspensions, because, like, you have to imagine, like, you trade for a guy like Kerfoot, hasn't done like anything compared to Kadri at that point in the league, and this guy walks in and says, yeah, how about a modified no move? Like, if you're any other GM, like, are you fucking stoned or something? We're gonna do a drug test before this thing even goes through, just for asking that. We might move you now to Arizona just for opening your mouth and recommending that. So, like, I would love to hear what they thought of Kerfoot when they traded him. Maybe they did think he was that guy, but clearly a modified no move is something crazy to think about for Kerfoot.
And the fact now we're talking about him being expendable is just absolutely hilarious, because obviously Colorado got it right. They saw an expendable player in Kerfoot. They had, what, Newhook, Compher, so many, you know, centers behind them, and they've easily passed them. If Kerfoot was still on Colorado, what line would he be on? The third line? fourth line.
Yeah, he's lucky, like, yeah. Third, yeah, fourth.
Something like, so that's my point. Like, Joe Sakic's a genius. He got Nazem Kadri. They just won a cup. And Dubas is looking foolish. You know, you get Barry for a year. Even in that year, you bring it up all the time. Riley went down with the injury, and that's when we expect Barry to get, what, 65 points? Didn't happen. So it is frustrating, especially when you look at the cap situation and you see guys like Kerfoot have a no-move clause, because that's just insanity. And then, of course, obviously, I love JT, but you look at that and you see $11 million. It's just like, what the hell, man? Just terrible.
I don't know how, like, after this year, that's going to be easier to move if you convince him. But he made a big commitment and changed his whole life around to come back to Toronto, that I think he'd feel disrespected if they asked him that.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. I think it's one of those situations where if you're Dubas, you know, you see what Tavares has been able to do in his career. And then this is, I think, going to be the fourth or fifth year with the Leafs now. Even what he's done when healthy is impressive. I'm not saying he's not a good player anymore by any means, but you look at what Steven Stamkos signed. He got $8.5 million. Teams were offering him $13 million, and he rejected that to stay where he was. Didn't have to move. He had a house there. Yes, he's from Toronto, but staying in Tampa Bay, there's no taxes there, so maybe that was another factor. But you see what the end result was. You know, he gets that team-friendly deal, arguably one of the best captains in the league, and bam, he wins two straight cups in a row. So if I'm a guy like John Tavares, and you see, it's unfortunate because at the time, you could argue he was worth about $10 million because he was making guys like Matt Molson and Okpozo fantasy relevant players, and even a guy like, pretty sure it was Anders Lee at the time. He had 40 goals with Tavares, but it sucks to see because from his fall from grace, just like Jamie Benn, very similar. Both the Art Ross race, man, 2014-15. Those were the top two guys in scoring, and now you look at both of them. They're one of the worst skaters in the league, and yeah, you know, they're both captains of their respective teams, but they're not near worth the amount of money they're getting. So it's very unfortunate, but you got to love JT.
Yeah, he's a good player still. I think just now where you are financially, it's a little rough. I think one way they could maybe take some of the pressure off is if they change a captaincy, put it to Matthews, make Tavares an A, and they do it respectfully, like kind of like what the San Jose Sharks did when they gave it to Jumbo Joe, had Marlowe, who was a captain. He's still involved in a like captaincy and just the leadership group, but he's just not wearing the C anymore. So if they want to do that similar approach as a way to say Matthews is going to lead this new era of the team, Tavares is going to be part of the leadership group, I think it might be a little bit well received.
Yeah, I agree. But the problem is, Alino, it's Toronto. If you do that in Toronto, the media could quickly spin everything around and say,
start, you know, drama.
Exactly. So Toronto is not, San Jose is not Toronto. So, I mean, that even, I remember that vividly back in the day when they gave it to Thornton and Marlowe had it for, I think it was 6-7 years. That was even in San Jose, that was a huge deal. So can you imagine if, I agree, I think they should do that. But if Matthews were to get the C and Tavares is the A, I think the media would have a field day with that one.
Oh, some TMZ type shit would happen. You'd have like some guy outside Tavares' house. So what do you think of Matthews getting the C? Just follow him around, write up articles saying that he doesn't like it and post it all over the internet and get some drama going at every game.
Toronto media. It's a circus. Just as FNUF, Loophole, and Kessel, how intense the Toronto media is, especially, hey, at least we're winning. If we were losing, holy crap, the media would I feel like Mitch Marner he would dip immediately. He'd be like, I'm freaking leaving here, because I feel like Marner gets the most hate.
Oh, for sure. Like, he's a guy, too. Like, he does everything you would think, like, fans want. Block shots, play defense, skate back, not lazy on a defensive end, scores goals. I think it's just because he's not 6'5" and 240 pounds that they look at it and look over those type of things.
Yeah, man, it's crazy. But we gotta see what happens with Dubas and Sandin and the cap structure. But now I gotta quickly move on to wrestling. Obviously, you know, it's gonna be very fun the beginning of September. You have two pay-per-views, Alino, Clash of the Castle, and you got All Out. But before we talk about that, we gotta talk about Raw, because it's coming to Toronto on Monday. And, you know, there are obviously some names that are rumored to be there. I saw Trish Stratus. She posted on Instagram. She looks like she's really in really good shape right now. What do you see with the women's division and the direction? Because, you know, we've seen that the three-on-three with Bianca, Asuka, and Alexa Bliss with – is it Alexa Bliss?
Yeah,
Alexa Bliss. Yeah, Asuka. It's Alexa Bliss with against, you know, the Bayley – EO and what's the other girl's name there? Dakota. So, like, what do you think about that? Because Trish Stratus, like, she's a known name. Charlotte hasn't been around. Becky's injured. Who do you see Trish Stratus going up against?
I think, like over the weekend, they're having her come in as, like, the host, like, kind of like what they did during the Christmas holiday and or in March. And I think they'll probably throw away some of idea or throw ideas at her. And I know the Becky Lynch one was the first one that she was even talking about, but now that she's injured, those plans change. It looks like Bayley might be the one. So with the Saudi Arabia show coming up, they're throwing $50 million for those events. So they're expecting some legends to come out. I wouldn't be surprised if, similar to last year we saw with Lita, I think we're going to see Trish versus Bayley as one of the matches, and they'll probably kick that feud off on Raw on Monday.
I like that. I think that would be pretty dope, honestly. And the biggest question is, where does that lead a girl like Bianca Belair? Because the year that she's had, simply phenomenal. Every match that I have seen, at least watching live, has been no less than B+. I think she's up there right now with the ranks of Charlotte Flair as one of the greatest in all of wrestling. I think, you know, a lot of people talk about Toni Storm, they talk about EO, they talk about Charlotte, Sasha, as, you know, the best of the best. But Bianca right now, she might be one of the best. So who do you see Bianca Belair feuding with if Trish Stratus goes off against Bayley?
Yeah, I'd like to see something different there. Like, I know they brought in Io Sky and Dakota there, but I hope they didn't rush that, because I know they're going after the tag titles. But if they need a secondary feud, like, I think Io would make sense, like her going after the title and then eventually to Bayley challenging for it again. So I'll go with Io first and then Bayley after her program with Trish.
Would you be surprised if we saw a heel turn maybe with Alexa Bliss?
Oh, yeah. You know, that's another one, too. Like, she's been a face for a while. And then with that whole Lily doll and now Triple H is in charge. So you might want to bring back the old character. I wouldn't put it past them to do that. I think that would make sense, too, if they want, like, something different. And, like, even look at SmackDown, what they're doing there with Liv as champion. Like, I think Alexa Bliss eventually, if they do a draft, she'll be going after one of those titles.
Oh, I love it, man. And speaking of, you know, SmackDown, Raw, you know, he's been on both shows. Drew McIntyre had a hell of a week, man. He's been really, they're really shoving him down our throats right now, but it's in a good way. It's not in a bad way, like a John Cena 2010 way. But what do you think about his feud so far with Kevin Owens, and of course the build with the Usos and Roman Reigns? Because again, we all know that Roman Reigns is not a full timer. We don't see him every week. That promo on Raw was, I thought it was phenomenal. And, you know, I think you hinted at it a couple weeks ago where Kevin Owens was, you know, rumored to bring back the prize fighter, Kevin Owens. And, you know, he did say that on Raw that he's officially brought it back. He attacked Ezekiel last week. What do you see with Kevin Owens moving forward? We see he has a sight set, I guess, on Drew right now. I think he's just trying to stay relevant. But do you see him winning a title before Finn Balor? With Triple H in charge?
I thought the whole, like, Drew and Kevin Owens pairing was interesting, because they're both kind of involved in some way in a big feud. Like, Kevin Owens with Austin at WrestleMania, then he goes into Ezekiel, but he's still the highlight of the show every week. And you see what Drew's doing with the Usos and Roman, and Sami Zayn's involved in that. So, like, Kevin Owens kind of hinted at, he's going after all the titles. He doesn't care who's champion. I think that's eventually going to lead to him joining Sami Zayn, and they're going to go after the Usos at probably the Saudi Arabia show.
Do you see Kevin Owens being a face, though?
Oh, man. I'd love to be, not like a full-on face, like, even though he made it work like a couple years ago, maybe like tweener, like him and Sammy in between, make Sami Zayn more of the babyface guy, and, you know, eventually Kevin Owens is going to turn on him and powerbomb him on the apron or something, but give him a nice little reign together. I think they could make it work. It'd probably be entertaining.
So you're basically saying that they should do what they did with Team Hell No all those years ago. They start out as heels, then they go tweeners, and then they're baby faces all of a sudden, and they have one of the most successful tag team title runs. So, hey, anything is possible with Kevin Owens. That guy's must see. But quickly now I want to transition to, you know, again, talk about the women again. Liv Morgan, she's been putting on quite great matches. Great feud she had with Ronda Rousey. It's looking like it's done for now. Ronda, again, like we mentioned, we predicted she would turn heel at the pay-per-view when it came through. What have you liked so far with Ronda as a heel? Because I see her kind of mingling with Shayna as well. Do you see a girl like Ronda Rousey being Shayna Baszler's manager at this point? Or do you see her maybe feuding with just, I guess, a random babyface at this point?
Yeah, I like that they didn't make her cut promos longer than 5 minutes. Thank God. Like, make it bullet points, say the line, and deliver it. I think that was the best way, and I think they're figuring it out with her. And I think Shayna's just going to run through Liv Morgan, become the champion, and lead to that whole, like, change there of Triple H being in charge. Because he always, I think, liked Shayna as a heel, and on NXT, she was, like, a dominant champion, so I think it'll probably lead to Ronda being in her corner more and bringing back that old version of her. And then they'll probably turn and we'll probably see them go one-on-one eventually.
I agree. I think Liv Morgan's run, I think it's run its course, honestly. Like, the little jabs that she does on SmackDown and all this stuff. I just feel like, again, with baby faces, the chase is way more valuable than when they have the title. And when they have the title, yeah, you know, the momentum is still kind of there, but is it really with a girl like Liv? I mean, she's still really green. She's improved a lot, but to me, this run is very similar to Carmella's, where, again, at first you're very happy for her to win. Like, she, you know, you get your moment, you win the title, but then when push comes to shove and there's better contenders out there, I feel like there's no choice but to have her lose here, so I agree with you 100%. I think now with Triple H in charge and we see the interconnection with Baszler and Triple H, I think eventually, you said it perfectly, you have Shayna win the title, you have Ronda maybe support her for a little bit just to maybe promote that one-on-one match, maybe at the Royal Rumble or somewhere down the line. So I agree with you there. But now I want to quickly talk about the actual pay-per-view. We have the main event. It's looking like it's going to be Drew McIntyre versus Roman Reigns. Again, Drew McIntyre has a lot of momentum. He's he came off a phenomenal match against Kevin Owens. He ended up attacking the Usos backstage, which I thought was absolutely great. Badass for Drew McIntyre. But there are rumors that he is dealing with a back injury. Now, does this have an effect on the potential outcome? Or do you still see Roman Reigns retaining? Because the more that I see online, Alino, and I know you're online a little more than me with the WWE, but I feel like they want to take at least one belt off of Roman.
Yeah, I think they have to at this point. Like, at WrestleMania, it made sense, the title for title with Brock. But, like, you know, Brock's not going to be full-time. Even at that point, he was kind of full-time from August to April. So, like, him being full-time for the rest of the year, I think it's a bit much. And you look at Roman, like, he was starting to phase out a little bit from being there every single week and every live event, scaling it back. So I think they need to take one title off and put it on Raw to help them build up more momentum on their show and build up another top guy. And I don't think it would make sense having Roman or Drew even going back and forth. Have one guy on one show, have another on the SmackDown show, and you can have a legit brand split like that. So I think Austin Theory is going to be lurking again. And I think he'll probably, after that big win over Dolph on Raw, he'll probably look to Drew McIntyre, and then they can make a whole WWE title scene there on Raw.
Yeah, I agree. I think if there's one guy that I could see maybe stealing it, I think it's against a guy like Drew, where maybe it's a hard-fought match. And finally, we get two different champions, and then bam, Austin Theory comes in, swoops in, wins the WWE title. And there he's now booked as the top heel, and you have Drew as the top face. I think that would make the most sense, regardless of the fact we've talked about it before. Roman Reigns versus The Rock is heavily promoted for WrestleMania. Doesn't have to have a title per se. I still think down the line, I really want to see Drew McIntyre hold the Universal title, because I want to see Cody Rhodes come back and win the WWE title for his dad, because he mentioned he doesn't want the Universal. He wants the WWE title. So with that being said, do you see Roman Reigns losing both titles before WrestleMania, or do you think they're going to maybe scrap Roman versus The Rock and maybe go with Roman versus Cody or something along those lines?
Yeah, I think this might be a crazy scenario, but like, I don't even think you're right that they don't need the title, because they did it even this year with Kevin Owens and Austin. Like, he didn't need to go chase a champion and have one more match. So I think Roman loses it, but probably at the end of the year or day one, like as a big move to get some buzz on the company. Day one is the first day of the year for WWE. It's like New Year's Day pay-per-view. So I think Roman holds it till then, and that's when we'll see The Rock come back for the Royal Rumble. I don't think he wins it. Maybe the Usos like come out, attack him, and take him out of it. But I think between Survivor Series and Royal Rumble, you have to reintroduce The Rock into the storyline and not just rush it from March until April.
I like it. Either way, man, I'm super excited, because Roman Reigns' run has just been, it's been on a different level. And it sucks that he's not full-time anymore, but I think it's better, honestly, for his aura, because he is that big of a deal. He's in the same light as, I guess, Brock and Cena now. So regardless, I'm excited. I guess this is the last question I got to ask you before we go to AEW. Do you see Drew McIntyre getting the job done in the UK, or you see Roman retaining?
Yeah, I feel like if they're going to do it, that would be the perfect place to do it. I think it's Drew going there. The stadium atmosphere over there is going to be crazy. All those fans. You know what? I'm going to go, yeah. Let's say Drew takes a title. It's something different. And then they'll probably do something on Raw saying that not both titles are on the line. It was only if he loses, it's the one he's had the least amount of time to save Roman. But I'll go with Roman losing the title at Clash of the Castle.
Yeah, I got to agree with you there. I think this is going to be – I think Triple H is looking for a mega pop. He's looking for a lot more public attention. And I think Drew McIntyre taking the title from Roman, I think, would actually do it, because I hate to say it, Roman Reigns retaining after a while doesn't get that much attention, because it's the same thing over and over again. So – you have a guy like Drew McIntyre win the title in UK, that would be absolutely phenomenal. But now to end the podcast, I want to quickly talk about AEW, what we've seen the past couple of...
Oh, Chris.
I had a phone call.
Sorry.
It's been absolutely incredible, AEW, man. Like, you have CM Punk versus Jon Moxley. We saw... this guy's doing snow angels while he comes out on his entrance. Are you kidding me? What did you think about the segment? I thought it was pretty jokes, but if they wanted to take it seriously, they did not get the job done there.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I think they're trying to make CM Punk, like, be in between a little bit. Like, I know he's not going to get booed in Chicago, so they're trying to make him in that in-between character before that, so like that the fans in Ohio will rally behind Jon Moxley a little bit. And after All Out, I think maybe CM Punk could commit more to being a little bit more of a heel, and we can see MJF maybe come back and challenge him for it, or another wrestler to come up and take the title. But I think right now, like, CM Punk is weathering that heel turn for AEW.
I love it. I think it's going to be phenomenal. This is a guy, also, shout out to him. He looks really good. He looks jacked. He looks a little bigger than when he came in. So you could tell he's definitely been motivated to get his body back into physical shape. And it's going to be a physical battle, man, with Moxley. Every single match he's in, there's just blood everywhere. So I got to ask you this question, kind of like what I said about Drew and Roman. Do you see that it's like SummerSlam 2011? You have two titles that are going to be on the promotional card. Do you see Moxley getting the win? It kind of, I feel like that's more of a underwhelming scenario. Or do you see CM Punk maybe winning in a screwy finish, maybe holding the tights, maybe doing something with the ropes and then holding the title? What do you prefer there? Because he did shout out Hangman Page in his promo.
Yeah, I'd like to see a screwy finish on Wednesday and leading to a triple threat. Hangman comes in and they do something at All Out with all three of them. They can have a good match. CM Punk retains. And then I want to see MJF come out to close the pay-per-view, similar to what they did last year with Adam Cole coming out and Bryan Danielson. Have MJF get into the ring there and talk about Grand Slam, which is that event on Dynamite they're going to have in the stadium in New York, their Arthur Ashe Stadium. So I think that'll be the perfect way for MJF to challenge for the title.
Oh, I love it, man. I think this might be MJF's time. You know, when you step away and you put on a promo like he did, yeah, you know, there's obviously going to be some conflict and some negative attention, but that's the point. You're getting attention. So MJF, the amount of attention that he's got, the amount of cheers that he also received after that promo was absolutely, to me, it was mind-boggling. I thought this was going to be a guy where a lot of fans would just absolutely dismantle and dislike him, but here we are. A lot of people are missing him. I think he's a very intriguing part to AEW television. And if he goes there, man, he comes back, goes up against CM Punk, a guy where he has a poster on his wall, I think that would just absolutely motivate MJF to be the best babyface, arguably, that he can be. And I think he would arguably be one of the most over guys in wrestling as a babyface.
That would be interesting. A heel like that who gets everybody in the crowd to hate him, to shift their whole stance on him, I think that would show just how good he really is. I think as a heel, he's amazing, but as a babyface, I think he can make it work.
I do too. It's either it'll work tremendously or it'll be like a Miz back in 2012 where he turned and it's like, oh, okay, this is fucking terrible. So either way, man, I'm very excited for Moxley and Punk. It's definitely for the future of the storylines and for the company, I think it's definitely intriguing because you really don't know what Moxley is. Like, he's not really a heel or a face. He's just a badass. And then you have CM Punk, who is supposedly the happy-go-lucky babyface, but then he says some comments and he does snow angels and it looks like he's clued out, kind of doing some heelish tactics there. So either way, I'm very excited. I think it's going to be a hell of a show, hell of a pay-per-view, but I gotta also ask you, what were your thoughts on Christian Cage and Jungle Boy? That segment, absolutely hilarious. I think this is a perfect scenario for both guys, Christian Cage being the veteran. You know, one of the best. I've missed him as a heel because last I think we saw him, he was a babyface in the main event with Randy Orton. He was one of the biggest babyfaces. Then he turned heel and then he turned babyface again. But what are your thoughts on Christian being one of those top heels in AEW at this stage against the young guy in Jungle Boy?
Oh, I love it. I think Christian showing he's reminding everybody just how great he is. I think everybody looks at Edge and like recency bias because they've both been out for so long and they look, oh, okay, Edge was a better one, and they forget like Christian's work over his years as a heel in WWE and TNA and then back in WWE, and he can play that role of an asshole really well. So I love what Christian's been able to do with Jungle Boy because he just gets people so mad with what he says about to Jungle Boy about his family, and then Jungle Boy comes out and then Christian just leaves and dips. So I love more of this out of Christian. I think it's only going to help Jungle Boy become a bigger star there in AEW.
Yeah, and even the fact that now he has Luchasaurus in his corner too, just, you know, I dismantled the tag team and all of a sudden Luchasaurus is just an absolute beast. So now you even have him in Christian's corner. Christian is, you know, that snarky, you know, cowardly heel, which I absolutely love. Kind of reminded me of Seth Rollins in 2014, obviously with less people. Seth had like five people. But regardless, man, I'm very excited for All Out, even Clash of the Castle. Both of them are going to be very, very fun. Make sure you guys out there are not doing anything on the Saturday and the Sunday because it's going to be strictly for wrestling. Going to be both phenomenal shows. But with that being said, Alino, you have anything else to add for today?
Yeah, just one thing there. Kenny Omega, we saw back.
How could I forget?
And good Canadian kid. That means he's going to for sure be wrestling there at All Out. And I don't know. Do you think he came back too soon? Because I'm looking at him. Like, he cut a promo after the show talking about if I have to have, like, athletic tape and all this extra stuff, you're still going to get, like, a Kenny Omega match. Like, you think he rushed it too soon there?
Yeah. I mean, again, you don't have MJF on TV. I think they were forced to do a panic move because, again, All Out is like WrestleMania in a big way. And I mean, you could argue that, but I feel like All Out is a big deal for AEW, and they need the big names there. And maybe El Nino, they didn't see CM Punk maybe coming back in time. They really didn't know how long his injury would be. But I do agree with you. I don't think he is 100%. I think maybe he's at about maybe 75, 80%. And you, again, injuries do play a part in changing storylines. Another guy that you mentioned before the pod went live, Adam Cole, is also apparently injured as well. So I think the fact with all those superstars not being clear to wrestle, I think it forced Kenny Omega to come back a little too soon.
Would you like to see Kenny be the one take the title off CM Punk, or should it be MJF?
I think just for storyline purposes, I think it would be pretty cool if it was MJF, but you never know, because Kenny Omega is that type of guy that regardless, he brings that market because he was in New Japan. You know, he's well-known everywhere. MJF is well-known everywhere, don't get me wrong, but just, you know, missing Kenny Omega for almost a year, it's been about 10 months since he's wrestled. It's just a big deal. It's kind of like what they're doing with Edge when he came back. He won the Royal Rumble and he got inserted into the main event immediately. I think it's going to be a similar build with Kenny Omega. I think when push comes to shove, he's probably going to do a one-off feud here just to get his feet wet. But right after that, he's going to be inserted in the title picture one way or another. It's either going to be him, I'll say Alino, Paige, or MJF to take it off of him.
I like it.
But anyways, that's going to be it for this week. As always, you know, Giancarlo Alino, Chris Martelli, talking about a lot of stuff today. Holy shit. Talking about a lot of stuff today. Nazem Kadri, a Calgary Flame. We got to continue. We talk about Rasmus Sandin and the Leafs. And, of course, talking about AEW, WWE, what's going on in the company, Clash of the Castle, and AEW All Out. Anyways, guys, that's In the Zone, signing out.